Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. Welcome to, I believe this is our ninth or tenth broadcast of Well Armed Radio. Started the show a few months back. My name is Nick Clark, president of Wisconsin Carry and host of Well Armed Radio. Thanks for being with us tonight. This is our weekly broadcast every night at 8 o'clock p.m. here live. We've got Dan is our call screener. Dan sitting in the green room as we speak, ready to take your calls if you'd like to call into the show tonight. For a phone number for calling in is 646-716-8739. Again, that number is 646-716-8739. That's the studio in New York, which is where our feed runs through. So I'm broadcasting from my home studio in New Berlin here, and that number goes to the studio in New York, which my feed goes back and forth through there. So speaking of my feed, hopefully from week to week, sometimes we have some issues with the phone connection with the dedicated line here. So hopefully we've got those worked out and everything's coming through well. Busy show tonight. You know, there's when I started the broadcast for Well Armed Radio a few months back, when I conceptualized the show, I was a little bit concerned that I didn't know if there'd be enough content from week to week to do a weekly show dedicated just to gun topics, especially considering that Well Armed Radio, our goal is not to be into the gun geek stuff like, no offense to gun geeks, but stuff like ballistics and gun reviews and that kind of thing, but really stick to the current events topics related to gun rights issues that have come up from week to week. So with that, this week, content is certainly not going to be an issue. We've got just a large amount of topics on the list for today. In fact, I'll be surprised if we get through all of them, but we'll give it a shot. So I know this is going to disappoint some of our listeners, especially Kurt, who loves it when I talk about boating. But I'll keep my boating discussion to a minimum this week for my intro. Good weekend for boating. Great weekend for everything here in Wisconsin. Just perfect weather. Spent the day yesterday out on Okaachi Lake with my fiance on the boat. Good time to be had there. If you're in the boating enthusiast category, Okaachi has a huge tie-up at the last Saturday of July. There's a huge tie-up out at Okaachi Lake, probably 500 boats. Quite a spectacle to see. This will be the first year I won't be going. My new boat's just too expensive to have amongst the revelry where they're launching beer cans with catapults from boat to boat and row to row. So it'll be my first year avoiding the debauchery. But for anyone else who'd like to partake, I highly encourage it. Just do it on someone else's boat. Last Saturday in July out on Okaachi Lake. So thanks to all listeners. As I mentioned, not last week's show, but the week before, we had our largest listenership ever. So for the seventh broadcast since we started the program, appreciate everybody tuning in. Hopefully in a good, obviously this show runs live here at 8 p.m. every Sunday. But the majority of our listeners actually listen from the podcast throughout the week. So several thousand listen to the show after we do the initial broadcast here. So, but certainly encourage our listeners who are listening to call in, and we're going to have some topics tonight that we not just hope, but strongly encourage you to call in and share your opinion on. We'd like to hear from you, get your feedback, get your input. We think that your participation in the show is important. It's important for me. I'd like to hear your perspective, and I think it's important for the content as we move forward, just to make sure that we have good participation from the listening audience. So, and I see the statistics. I know you're out there, so don't be afraid to call in. I wonder if that long distance phone number might keep the calls down. Sometimes there's a fee that I can pay for the 800 number, but I haven't decided to put that through yet. I was waiting for some of the sponsorships for the program to kick in before we move over to the 800 number, but I figured a lot of people now have just cell phones, and long distance is typically free on most cell phone plans. So definitely be encouraged to call in. That number again is 646-716-8739. Should be at the top of your broadcast media, your player there on the screen that you tune into the feed from. So with that, again, no shortage of topics today. We'll start off with the news of the week, and had some of this came in real late in the day today. Obviously, the events of this past week unfolding. So we're going to start off with some of a brief recap of some of the news of the week, and then get into our main topics. Two main topics this week. One is the George Zimmerman verdict came down last night around 10 p.m. I believe, a verdict of not guilty in that case. I think for those of us who've watched the case since its inception, it's the verdict that we believed was appropriate. Certainly, from the initial media coverage of the situation, we think that there was rush to judgment and some outrage inciting news coverage that really fanned the flames on this one in a case that otherwise might not have generated the coverage that it did. But we'll keep the remaining comments to that for later in the show. The other topic that we'll go over this week is the U.S. Bank. A bit of a dust-up last week with U.S. Bank sending some threatening letters to customers who they thought may have been carrying in their branches. And then there's a third topic we have also is the short topic we'll do on the shootout here in Milwaukee on I-43, I think 2 weeks ago, which just recently was reported this past week. A reporter from the Journal contacted me earlier in the week and asked me if I had heard any details on it, and I hadn't. So he shared some in confidence before that story was published, and that's late in the week here. That story was certainly a topic on local news stations. So we'll get to that one. Some other small stories that we have for this week is we'll run through these here. First one that I had was an interesting one. One of the frustrations that we here in the concealed carry movement have had is that obviously there's places where private property where you're prohibited from carrying a concealed weapon by the choice of the owner of the establishment. Obviously, while we think it's foolish for places to post their property and prohibit carry, we certainly support private property rights, and because of that, we respect the decisions of private property owners who decide to prohibit carry on their property, whether their property is a business or their personal property. And certainly with the business, we typically choose to take our business elsewhere. We respect their right to make the decisions that are best for them and their decisions that are best for them and their business in their mind, and we'll make the decisions that are best for us as a consumer. But there's some places that we aren't allowed to carry. One of those is schools. And anybody who's been a concealed carry or open carrier has certainly probably become frustrated with the with the necessity to not just leave your gun in your vehicle, but when you go on school property, so if you want to go to your kids' basketball game or any other event at the school, you have to unload and put your gun in a case and secure it in the car because you cannot carry onto school property, school grounds at all. So first story I have this week is some school districts that are allowing off-duty police to carry at school events. This was a story that someone just posted to Wisconsin Carry Facebook page today, and so I thought that we'd talk about this one. And I have some other angles to add to this. Some information that I have from a few months back. But this particular story is out of a Schwabenon. There's some school districts in the Green Bay area that say it's okay for off-duty police officers to bring their guns to school events. Reading from the article here in the Journal Sentinel, Schwabenon School Board has recently approved the move. Green Bay School District has a similar agreement with local police. Green Bay Press Gazette reports that Wisconsin's concealed carry law, enacted November 2011, prohibits weapons in some areas, including schools. But the law allows concealed weapons on school grounds if districts reach an agreement with an individual or their employer to carry. School officials say it's a preventative measure and provides added security. Obviously, I would agree with that last statement, that it's a preventative measure and provides added security. But the law allows concealed carry weapons on school grounds. That's something that some people aren't aware of, that Wisconsin's law does allow with the agreement of the school. So typically the school district superintendent can give permission for people to possess firearms on school property. So as an example, if someone's teaching a hunter safety class in a school, they can get permission from the district administrator, perhaps the principal, whoever's authorized to make those kinds of decisions on behalf of the school or the district. And the story that I'm going to add to this is that earlier this spring, I was contacted by, and I'm going to keep the names out of it here to protect the not so innocent, but I was contacted by a police chief here in southeast Wisconsin. And again, I'm not going to use his name or his department, but some of you are aware that Wisconsin Carry and our membership killed a bill last year and the year before that Joel Clefett had introduced, which would basically give blanket permission to police officers off duty and former. On-duty police officers can carry on school grounds all that they wish during the course of their duties, but off-duty police officers and former police officers have to live by the same rules that we, the people, have to live by. And because of that, they're exposed to the same potential criminal charges if they were to carry on school property, just like we would be. So this police chief from a southeast Wisconsin department calls me and said that he had spoken with Joel Clefish, and this bill that's been authored and introduced the past two legislative sessions, which Wisconsin Carry keeps killing, would have given that blanket permission to off-duty and former police officers to carry on school grounds without having to get the permission of the district. So what had happened for this police chief was that he had contacted several local districts, and some of the districts he had obtained permission for his officers to carry on school grounds off duty. But some of the districts where perhaps the individual who headed up the district was a not so carry friendly person to police or anyone had refused his request. And so he was then looking to Madison for legislation to make sure that his officers, and he called me, and I don't want to make this sound too pejorative, but he called me with a sob story about how concerned he was about his officers being exposed. You know, someone could just be at their kid's soccer game and end up getting in trouble and you know, risking their career and their you know, livelihood. And I said, hey, I feel your pain. I have the same concerns for our membership and our members who might go on school grounds and, again, you know, leave their gun in their car but not unload it in a case and expose themselves to the very same potential legal repercussions. So I'd suggested to him that, hey, this is a great opportunity. You know, we support, you know, your desire to keep your officers free from harm's way in terms of criminal penalties, and certainly I want to keep our members and anybody who wishes to exercise their human right to self-defense free from criminal prosecution, law-abiding citizens free from criminal prosecution. So let's go to Madison and And there's an amendment to the bill that Joel Clefish had authored. When I spoke to Joel, that he had suggested that he would add an amendment in committee that this law would apply to all concealed carry license holders. Now, certainly, we support constitutional carry, and we think it should just apply to everybody who's legally allowed to carry, but, you know, baby steps. So I said to Joel, yes, we'd support that amendment. For that reason, we would be willing to support the bill with that amendment. And I suggested to this police chief that let's go to Madison. You support the amendment that Joel is going to offer, and I'll support the bill with our membership. But the police chief thought that that was going to weigh the bill down, and for that reason, he didn't want to offer his support to us in exchange for our support for the portion of the bill that benefit him. So I've been involved in a lot of negotiations in my life, but I've never found a good negotiation where you don't get anything and you give up everything. So I respectfully told the police chief that I didn't think that at this point there was anything we could offer, because we weren't going to support a bill that gave special privileges to police only without an opportunity at least to have the legislature at least take an up or down vote on giving that same privilege, I shouldn't say privilege, that same right to we the people. So that was the last I spoke with him. It was a cordial conversation. Hopefully we'll get to talk again in the future. But that's just something to share in addition to this story in the paper here today, at least the online version, talking about school districts that allow their off-duty officers to bring guns to school events. That's happening across the state. It's already happening. And like I said, it applies to private schools too. If you can reach an agreement with the administrators of your local school, certainly there's a legal remedy. There's an option within the statutes that allows you to carry. So that was the first topic I had. Second, moving along here, and feel free to call in if you'd like to share your opinion on this as we run through these news events of the week. If you have an opinion one way or the other on any of these, you're more than welcome to call in 646-716-8739. Second topic of the week, Illinois concealed carry legislation. This finally passed. You know, I had this up for a topic of discussion last week and the week before, but we got busy with other topics. But Illinois has passed. Governor Quinn had made some amendatory vetoes. You know, a lot of people, when Illinois originally passed their concealed carry legislation a month or more ago, were very excited and ready to check off Illinois as the final state that had a blanket prohibition against concealed carry. And now they do allow, you know, now with their law passed, they want to check them off the list, and that we now, every state has some form of concealed carry legalized. I was not so optimistic. I know Chicago politics and wasn't completely on board with the fact that this was going to happen so easily. And sure enough, the Illinois governor made some what's called the mandatory vetoes. They have a different legislative process down in Illinois, go figure. But they can do some mandatory vetoes where it's different than a line item veto. You can actually add things to a law. So the governor can, with the stroke of his pen, add something into a law that isn't there. Now, obviously, that's still subject to the legislature's approval. But Governor Quinn issued some mandatory vetoes that really changed the you know, added magazine capacity restrictions, prohibited carry in public places unless there was signs allowing for carry. So if, here in Wisconsin, if you don't see a sign, carry on. In Illinois, with the mandatory veto, if you don't see a sign that allows carry, you cannot carry. Now, that was the mandatory veto that was passed. Now, that both of those were overridden by the legislature. So what's next for Illinois? It should be, and I say should be, because there's still a lot of Illinois tricky politics that could happen here, a lot of Chicago politics, a lot of time for Chicago politics to take place. But in Illinois, 180 days, I believe, is what the Illinois State Police, who are the ones who are going to administer the permit system, the Illinois State Police will be in 180 days, or was it 120? I forget the exact quotation, but within 180, 120 days, they'll be having that permit system. In Illinois, all gun owners already have to have a FOID card, a firearm owner's identification card. But now that's not enough. You have to have, and Illinois' law is very strict. I believe it's, I want to say, 15 hours of training, including live fire. There's, I think it's a $300 permit fee. So a lot of hoops to jump through down in Illinois. Some limitations that you're not allowed to carry on, the mass transit. So no buses, no the L, the subway, not allowed to carry there. So the good thing is, with that law's passage, right now you can now drive into Illinois and you do not have to unload and encase your gun at the border. So that's something that applies right now because this legislation is passed. You can, when you drive to Illinois, have a loaded handgun in your vehicle. You cannot get out of the vehicle with your loaded handgun, but as it's called pass-through. So you can pass through Illinois with a loaded gun in your vehicle. So that's something for people to now be aware of. We'll have some more updates. We'll probably have Belinda Rowe from Illinois Carry back on the show. She was on a few weeks ago, and we'll have her back on to talk about some other topics. I think the last thing I would say, and I still, every time I hear it, it gives me, makes me cringe, that Illinois is now the final state to allow concealed carry. And technically that's true, but as we all know, there's a good 5 to 10 states. I don't know the exact number. I want to say it's around 10 states that don't have shall issue. They have what's called may issue. And so states like California, states like New York, they're may issue states where you can carry concealed with permission of whatever entity they've given discretion over issuing permits. But it's in some cases difficult for people to actually obtain a permit. You basically have to have be someone important and have friends in high places in order to get that may issue permit. So I hesitate. I think we should start talking about right to carry in terms of two new paradigms, one which many of us are already familiar with, which is constitutional carry. I think that people should, that's the goal is to, we should all have is to move people towards that discussion that constitutional carry is where we'd like to move. Right now we have 4 states that allow constitutional carry, right to carry without a permit, so that you're not tracked by the government or taxed by the government for exercising your right to carry. And then the other thing is we should start talking in terms of, and it looks like we've got a call coming in here, so we'll pick up this phone call in a second here, but it looks like, or the other topic or the other classification would be shall issue. You know, I think while we talk about all states allowing concealed carry, I think the people that are in some of these states that are may issue states are kind of waving their hand saying, hey, wait a minute, you're counting us in the green list of places that allow carry, concealed carry, but it's really difficult to get a permit. So for that reason, we don't want to leave those people behind in the discussion. So we'll take this phone call in a second here. I'm ready to jump on to my next topic, but we'll wait for Dan to get done screening the call. I'll throw a quick one in here. The Second Amendment Foundation, great organization, who I've had the distinction of being asked to participate in their annual conference, which was held in Illinois a few years ago and had the opportunity to speak there. But Second Amendment Foundation put together a great little project, which they're calling the, there's Mayor Bloomberg's group, which is called the Mayors Against Illegal Guns, which is, you know, more aptly named Mayors Against Guns. But there's also, now the Second Amendment Foundation has a new initiative that they call Gun Owners Against Illegal Mayors. So a little turn the tables here. And I posted this to the Well-Armed Radio Facebook page, facebook.com/Well-Armed Radio, so you can go take a look at this there. But this is basically there's a list of all of the mayors who are part of Mayor Bloomberg's Mayors Against Illegal Guns. These mayors whom are now felons and not legally allowed to own guns. So I'm not going to read them all off here, but there's some local politicians, former mayors who've made the blacklist here. Gary Becker from Racine, mayor convicted of attempted child molestation and luring a child for illicit purposes. He's now got the dubious distinction of being a highlight of the Gun Owners Against Illegal Mayors. And again, he was formerly part of Mayor Bloomberg's Mayors Against Illegal Guns. And there's probably, I think on this page, there's 18 or 20 mayors listed who were part of Mayor Bloomberg's group and are now have been convicted of felony charges. So that's an interesting that's been posted to the Well-Armed Radio Facebook page. So swing over there and take a look at that. We've got Tom on the line from Janesville, so we're going to bring Tom here. Tom, welcome to Well-Armed Radio. Thanks for calling in.
Hey, Nick. Thanks for the show. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for giving me a chance to take a sip of water here. What's your comment?
Well, I guess I want to talk a little bit about the Illinois concealed carry. I've been carrying in Wisconsin. Well, I got my permit a couple of years ago in November, and I traveled to Michigan quite a bit. It sort of stinks when I hit the state border just before I have to pull over, take my gun, put it in a case, take my ammo, put it in a separate case, drive through the state when I get to Indiana, because I have reciprocity with several licenses, I can take it out. My girlfriend gets a little upset because I have to pull over. She wants to get to visit her mother, so. But now with the concealed carry that they have there, they're not going to have reciprocity with us, so I don't know. It's not going to be any different.
Yeah, well, they do have the pass-through law, so you don't have to pull over. Certainly, you can't carry outside the vehicle, but they do have the pass-through law, so now you can don't have to unload and encase your gun when you're driving through. So at least, and of course, you know, Chicago is such a safe city. You know, there certainly would never be a need to be armed in Chicago. But I guess the advice there is to stay in your vehicle and get your safe harbor. So. But, Tom, thanks for calling in. What are you packing tonight?
Glock 30.
Excellent. I think I was thinking of doing this tonight, but I'm going to do it one of these days. I'm gonna have a little prize giveaway for what I'm packing, because I have a good collection of guns, and I'm going to play with that one of these nights. But, Tom, thanks for calling in. Thanks for being part of the show.
Yeah, hey, thanks again for the show, though, Nick. I really appreciate it.
Thanks
for tuning
in.
Okay, bye.
Be well-armed. And we got another call here, Kurt from Oak Creek. We'll put Kurt live. Kurt,
hey Nick, how's it going?
Good. How are you?
I am doing okay, all things considered.
Were you out on the lakes all weekend, I'm sure?
No, but I was actually down near the lakefront for a good portion.
Well, that's the best place to be. South Shore Frolics, or just down by the regular part of the lake?
Oh, just all over. Spent a lot of time down in Third Ward.
Yeah, excellent. Well, Kurt, what's my first question I have to ask is, what you're packing tonight?
CZ-75BD.
Excellent. Your everyday carry.
Yes, it is.
Well, Kurt, what's your comment?
Not a backup or two, but that's pretty much it. Well, I was actually calling regarding Bloomberg's mayors against illegal guns.
How do you like that?
Yeah, I'm not going to use the language I'm thinking of, so I'll just move on. There's an article that I ran across, and I've seen the same information a few places. Milwaukee is actually one of the places where mayors against illegal guns have a lobbyist that they have put on the city or county payrolls.
Interesting.
In Milwaukee, it's Paulina D. Hahn, according to the news article I had, regional coordinator, mayors against illegal guns, is on Milwaukee's payroll.
Interesting. You know, I think let's get some documentation of that, because I'd like to do some open records requests and find out, what kind of taxpayer money is being spent to lobby against our very own rights.
Well, I'm sending you a link right now.
Perfect. Well, Kurt, thanks for calling in. I appreciate you being part of the show.
All righty. You have a good day, Nick.
Bye-bye. Be well armed. Kurt, longtime listener from Oak Creek. Appreciate him calling in. Kurt's always on top of things, so I'm looking forward to getting that that information pertinent here to the topic we had with gun owners against illegal mayors. So next topic I had for discussion tonight was Northwoods Mine protests. Some of you might have seen this late last week. There's some video. You know, these protesters. Just eco terrorists, I think, is what some have termed them as, and I certainly think that's applicable and appropriate. I don't think that's a misstatement. It shows them. They posted this video. I think they're proud of themselves. Posted this video, and we saw this here in Wisconsin during the Act 10 protests in Madison, where where you know, these career protesters, these people without a life, people that feel such a void in their life that they have to do something, and as an outlet for their issues, they protest, and that's what they do. And so they don't seem to be very educated in terms of the things that they're protesting against. You know, sometimes these people, one day they're protesting that American jobs are going overseas, and the next day they're protesting a mine that would bring those American jobs here. So they really don't have principles. They, you know, there's people who there's two ways to think, and you know, everybody has a right brain and a left brain, and one side of your brain controls emotion, and one side of your brain controls logic. And well-adjusted people have the ability to branch those pathways between your left brain and right brain and make logical decisions based upon both. But I think, and I would make the contention that successful people learn how to let their logic dictate their emotions. It's okay to be emotional, but you got to let your logic dictate your emotions. And then I would argue that the people who have difficulty in life, finding happiness, finding success, are people that let their emotions dictate their logic. When you let your logic and your principles dictate your emotion, you know, you can be an emotional person, you can feel, but those feelings are controlled, and it's more of an enjoyment because you've let your principles and your logic dictate your emotions. But these people who let their emotions dictate their logic, what you'll find is that your emotions, when they're not tempered by logic, when we talk about crazy, this is, you know, people, emotions are crazy things when they're not dictated by logic. And so these protesters, I mean, these are people that let their emotions, that's why they're so hypocritical. That's why one position of theirs doesn't jive with another, because they're really acting based upon emotion. And if you watch this video of these mining protesters, you'll see exactly what I'm talking about. And this is all over the internet. So you could, Milwaukee Journal Sentinel had a a link to the video, so you can certainly go there and watch it. I was going to pull some audio from it, but I didn't have the chance, and I just don't think without the video it has quite the same effect. But these Northwoods Mine protesters running through the woods with camouflage ponchos and masks on, and going and basically assaulting some workers from the mining company who are out there doing some testing. I don't know if it's some soil sample testing or something, but they've got a small group of people that are part of the mining company. And this group of eco-terrorists run through the woods, assault these people, you know, screaming and yelling, and they're videotaping the whole thing. They find, you know, six or seven of these workers of the mine. Is a very, very remote section. I mean, you know, police, we often use the cliche, when seconds count, police are minutes away. Here, when seconds count, police are probably a half hour away. I mean, that's how remote this part of Wisconsin is. And these eco-terrorists assault the workers. One worker tries to pull out a cell phone to call for help. I mean, trying to do what all the anti-gun folks say you should do instead of being armed, you know, call the police. Well, here, these eco-terrorists took the phone out of her hand, so she can't call the police. And this the video all documents this very well. You know, there's been felony charges, I believe, surprisingly. Someone was actually charged. Seems like for so long here, protesters in Wisconsin have a carte blanche to ignore the law, and police in Madison look the other way, and the DAs in Madison look the other way. But this person was charged with a felony. I mean, you can threaten the governor's life and not be charged and all these other things, but I digress. So this individual was cited felony charges for what this female eco-terrorist did to this other female employee of the mining company, taking her phone and her camera. So the mining company, and this is the story in the journal, the mining company hired a company called Bulletproof. This is a company out of Arizona. It's called Bulletproof, and it provides armed security for, you know, corporations. So what was interesting here is the reaction that this got from the various people in, you know, politicians and others. The reaction from Bob Jauch, who is the Democrat legislature from this area, is very interesting. So I'm going to read part of the story here. Local, citing an incident of threats and vandalism a month ago, mining company in northern Wisconsin is standing by its decision to bring an out-of-state security company that outfits its guards with camouflage, fatigues, and assault rifles and calls itself bulletproof. Some local officials and Democrat lawmakers have criticized the action, saying it adds to the tension of a situation already inflamed by exploratory drilling and an environmental protest last month that led to felony charge against one woman. Both the guards of Bulletproof Security's firm and the protest group responsible for the vandalism have been criticized for wearing masks. Ashland County Board Chairman Pete Russo said the response by Gogebic Taconite was overboard compared to the threat so far. Well, I've seen the video, and I have to be honest, I don't think that response is overboard. I don't think it's overboard to have a show of force to protect your company, your financial interests, the employees. And furthermore, this is a remote section of forest, and these protesters are choosing to insert themselves into the situation. So given that felony charges have already been issued against protesters, I mean, the threat has been proven with these felonious actions, and there's no reason not to suggest that the actions could escalate. There's a topic I'm going to get into before we talk about George Zimmerman today, and it's denial, and I've been I'm not going to jump the gun and jump into that now, but this is what we have here is denial, where these people, the evidence is here, and these politicians, these anti-gun folks, just live in a state of denial. So here I'm going on to read is his main concern is you've got people in camouflage carrying semi-automatic weapons. This is a cocktail for disaster, said Russo, whose county includes much of the Penike Hills, though not the site where Gogebic is currently operating. There's a lot of people who are upset about this, he's quoted as saying. So there's a couple other interesting things that I pulled from this article, and one was Bob Jauch's comments. I'm going to read those to you. Senator Bob Jauch, Democrat from Poplar, said Gogebic had a right to protect its employees and properties, but had gone too far in hiring intimidating guards from Bulletproof, which is based in Scottsdale, Arizona. Jauch said he didn't object to Gogebic's use of local security, such as sheriff's deputies who had been dressed in typical law enforcement uniforms armed with pistols. So now I'm going to pause this for a second here. The two things that I find shocking about Bob Jauch's comments are, first, sheriff's deputies who'd been dressed in law enforcement uniforms armed with pistols. First and foremost, remember what I said a few weeks ago, how politicians love guns, but they only love, you know, anti-gun folks. They're not really anti-gun. They're anti-you, because these anti-gun politicians actually do love guns. They love when their private security force has them. The president loves his Secret Service who have guns. They love guns in the hands of the police force. What they don't like is guns in the hands of someone that they don't control. It's really about control. So Bob Jauch, of course, loves guns, but only in the hands of local police officers who he knows darn well in this situation are, you know, half hour away, and that's being generous, if something was to happen and these people needed to defend themselves. So once again, we have a politician demonstrating that the only people that they trust with guns are the people that take their orders from other politicians. Politicians never have a problem when it's government with the guns, but I'll go on with the article. Bob Jauch called Gogebic to drop Bulletproof, which describes itself as a no-compromise security force, saying that level of force was not needed in an environment where most protesters are peaceful, Jauch said. And right there again, most protesters are peaceful. Well, unfortunately, Bob, it's not the most that people, Gogebic, the company, or anyone else has to worry about. It's the few. I mean, I could walk down the street and most people aren't going to assault me. But you walk through some parts of Milwaukee and you could walk by 100 people who don't assault you, but it's the one person who does assault you that's the problem. So again, Bob Jauch demonstrates this state of denial that he lives in. So then Bob goes on to say it's this change that is bothering people. It's not the security. They can't justify this militarized security, Jauch said. Again, this is a remote operation that these mining companies are doing in the middle of a forest, in the middle of Wisconsin, miles and miles away from anybody else. And the only people in the area are these terrorists, these eco-terrorists who are trying to disrupt. And when I say trying to disrupt, I mean they're breaking the law to disrupt what the legislature has said can go on there and what these companies have a right to do. But again, he talks about this militarized security, and it's an interesting juxtaposition because I have a feeling that Bob Jauch has no problem with militarization of police forces. And I'm going to use an example, Milwaukee. I've talked for years about how Milwaukee Police Chief Ed Flynn has militarized the police force. They've taken shotguns out of cars, out of cruisers, and put automatic weapons, not semi-automatic weapons, automatic weapons in those cars. You know, shotguns, which are well-suited for urban environments and crowd control because they can be chambered with non-lethal rounds. An example of militarization of the police force. But I don't hear Bob Jauch having any problem with police officers running around the streets with automatic weapons. No problem there because, again, that's government with guns. And if there's one thing that we've proven to ourselves over the years, it's that these anti-gun politicians are only anti-gun in your hands. They're not anti-gun in the hands of police or anyone else who takes orders from politicians. But we have armored vehicles now. We see armored vehicles, Milwaukee Sheriff's Department, Milwaukee Police Department, Waukesha County Sheriff's Department, Waukesha County Police Department. They have armored military vehicles. I mean, these are the same vehicles that we would see in Iraq and Afghanistan driving around the streets whenever they have a tactical situation. They can't wait to get out their armored vehicles. We saw this in Waukesha where there was an airsoft gun scare, and the police knew it was an airsoft gun scare hours before they went and took their military vehicles and their automatic weapons and stacked up and went into the apartment where they knew someone had a broken airsoft toy. But Jauch, again, back to his comment that they can't justify this militarized security, I don't hear Bob Jauch or any other of these politicians having any problem with the militarization of the police forces around southeast Wisconsin or anywhere in Wisconsin. Back to Milwaukee, Ed Flynn loves to have military-like roll calls in the streets of the inner city that are eerily reminiscent of some Chinese communist parade. Ed Flynn refers to his officers as troops. He's got these saturation patrols. They no longer focused on responding to calls for help, but instead saturate high crime areas. I mean, literally with just a saturation of police. This is locally. So this militarization that Bob Jauch is so offended by when it's in a remote section of the northern Wisconsin woods where there's been felony assaults against individuals who have a right to protect themselves, he's got a problem with that. But I've never heard him or anybody else of these anti-gun politicians speaking out against the militarization of police forces around the state. That's here locally. We look at the nationally. I mean, you know, the bulk ammunition buys from the Department of Homeland Security. We see reports of the IRS being trained with tactical rifles. All this militarization of domestic law enforcement. And that is scary stuff. But again, I don't hear any resistance, any speaking out against that by these liberal anti-gun politicians. We only hear it when there's, and in those cases, one might argue that it's overboard. We'll save that for a different topic. But here's a case where this company is responding to a real threat that occurred, a felony assault that occurred against their employees. And now they're being criticized for that. I think that's just shameful, and it really demonstrates the hypocrisy of these guys like Bob Jauch. Going on the article, Bob Seitz, a spokesman for Golgebic, gave no sign of dropping bulletproof, saying the company had done a great job and has been nothing but professional. He also said the remoteness of the mine lengthened the response times of on-duty sheriff's deputies. And again, this is where seconds count. Police are only 30 minutes away. By the time that the sheriff's deputies would respond to a call from Golgebic, and hoping that they do respond to a call from Golgebic instead of, you know, hey, we're busy, we've got other, you know, we've got speeding tickets to write. I mean, this is the problem with when your security is dependent upon the government, because now you're hoping that and who knows what politics are at place up there in the sheriff's departments and the police departments, but you're hoping to be able to call someone else for help. And we all know in the right to carry movement that the only person you can count on for help is yourself. That's the only person who's always going to be there to protect yourself, because the police have no duty to respond. The Supreme Court has found that the police have no duty to respond. And again, even when they do respond, you can't be assured that they can respond in a timely enough manner. Other interesting part of this article that, you know, that goes on to say that, you know, in this assault that occurred where the protester assaulted the employee, they took the employee's camera and her cell phone. So again, it's going to be impossible to do what Bob Jauch says and call the police, call the sheriffs to come respond when the eco-terrorists have taken away your phone. So it's just shameful. It's just another example of these politicians who don't care anything about individuals. All they care about is control and their control. And this is the kind of hypocrisy that we just need to expose as often as we can. Next topic I had, this one is from Milwaukee, and this was a disturbing one. Southside mother raped and held hostage in her home. A couple years ago, there was a well-publicized story out of Connecticut where there was an individual, a doctor and his family who were in their home. Three thugs came into their home, literally raped and pillaged, you know, raped the daughters. The husband was the doctor. I mean, this is a very well-to-do neighborhood, so people say it couldn't happen in this neighborhood. It happens in those neighborhoods. But this case out of Connecticut where this doctor was tied up in his basement while he could literally hear his wife and his 16-year-old daughters being raped upstairs by these thugs. And then they took his wife to the bank. You might remember the story from a couple of years ago. Took his wife to the bank, made her withdraw a bunch of money, brought her back, raped her. And while she was at the bank, she gave a note to the teller that she needed help. The teller calls police. Police set up a perimeter. So now the police have a perimeter set up. While the police have a perimeter set up around the house, the thugs inside continue to rape the women. I think there was the mother and two daughters. And while the husband is again tied up, police didn't go in. And again, this is just there's no one that can protect you but yourself. In this situation in Connecticut, the father escaped out the basement window, finally ran to the neighbors, and then the police went in at the same time, before the police went in, these thugs lit the house on fire and torched it and ran out. The wife and daughters were killed. The husband lived only because he had escaped out the basement. But the police, you know, had this perimeter set up and didn't go in. So a similar story here, and this, you know, we hear that, and that's out east, but a similar story here that happened here in Wisconsin, and this is just scary stuff. And it's the reason why we are not paranoid because we carry. We are informed. We are aware. That's the reason that we carry. So here, this particular story, and I couldn't imagine. I couldn't imagine being in my house when my wife was being raped and you were tied up. I couldn't imagine what that must be like. So here in the South Side story here, this court documents detail a laundry list of evil acts forced on a Southside Milwaukee family. A woman, her husband, and their 4-year-old son were watching a movie at home when the mother heard a noise and saw three subjects standing in the kitchen area with guns pointed at her and her family. Three men had guns, masks, and gloves on. During the course of their nightmare, the husband was tied up and the mother was repeatedly raped after she was forced to drive to an ATM to withdraw cash twice. Police arrested two men, Omar Riviera and Julio, I can't say the last name, Quiles Guzman. A third suspect hasn't been charged yet. But in the wake of such a gruesome crime, victims' advocates want the public to know cases like this are very rare. Statistically speaking, most sexual assaults are perpetrated between people that know each other, said Diane Ripple of the Women's Center. Those statistics are staggering. Now, this is just shocking. I mean, it's a shocking, the angle that the news media takes on this. Here's when a concealed carry, and we're going to get to this story later, when something happens with a concealed carry permit holder, does the news media go running to point out the statistics that it's very, very rare that a concealed carry permit holder ever does something unlawful with their weapon? But yet here, you know, now we're off to victims' advocacy groups talking about that rape by a stranger is rare. That's not even the context of the story here. The context of the story is this family was assaulted. And again, phone number to call in if you'd like to respond to anything we talk about here tonight is 646-716-8739. Again, that's 646-716-8739. But this, you know, this story where here's a family here in Milwaukee that's first thing I would say is, you know, sometimes, I mean, I carry around the house. I carry when I mow the lawn. I carry there. The only time I don't have a gun on me is when I'm wet. So that means when I'm in the water at the lake or when I'm taking a shower. Any other time I've got a gun. And the reason is, if I'm sitting watching, I mean, here's a lady who is sitting watching TV, and you know, and these anti-gun folks would say, who needs to carry a gun while you're watching TV with your family? Well, here's a woman who did. So the gist of this story is basically that this sort of a case of mistaken identity, which it doesn't matter, mistaken identity or not, a rape is a rape, an assault is an assault, an attack against you and your family is an attack against you and your family. But the, you know, here's a case here in Milwaukee where a woman was held hostage, you know, driven to the bank, made to withdraw money, raped and sexually assaulted multiple times. And I talked about denial earlier, and you know, people live in a state of denial that this couldn't happen to them and this couldn't happen here in Wisconsin. When we see these things, it's someplace else. But it can happen, and it does happen. And we're not paranoid. We're just prepared. So just something to be aware of as you, you know, when you have someone making the comments to you that, you know, no one needs to carry a gun while they're sitting and watching TV. Next topic that we had, and again, feel free to call in if you'd like to respond to any of these. This one I had 2 weeks ago, and we didn't have time for it, but Chicago, we know Chicago now has passed a concealed carry law. They don't yet have permits issued, so this is an unfortunate case where you know, the law didn't come in time to protect this family. But there was a pizzeria owner in Illinois who his – and the reason I bring up this story is the media tries so hard to brush aside Chicago's murder rate as being gang violence, and sure, certainly some of it could be, but it's more than that. Here's a case in Chicago where this Italian immigrant was gunned down in his Chicago pizzeria when he confronted a suspect trying to save his wife from harm. I should post this article to the I'll post this article to the Well Armed Radio Facebook page. But you can see, in fact, I'm going to do that right now as we speak. So if anybody wants to multitask and go to the Well Armed Radio Facebook page, we'll see if I can do this and type and talk at the same time. But there's a picture that you should take a look at. And that's the reason I'm going to post this link on the Well Armed Radio Facebook page. And here we go. Cut, paste, and it is now up. So there you go. If you go to the Well Armed Radio Facebook page, you see a picture of this thug in a red shirt with his, and it just stereotypical. I mean, he's got the gun gangster style. He's got it pointed sideways, you know, at this Italian, you know, here's a guy, Italian immigrant trying to make it, trying to run his business. And here's a thug comes in, probably someone who you and I are paying for his Obama phone and paying for his food stamps. Probably getting a lot from society, and he's now, you know, breaks into and goes against goes up against someone who's trying to work for an honest living and kills him, trying to rob his restaurant. But the media tries so hard to brush this Chicago violence problem aside as gang violence, and it's not. And here's an example of that. And this is a perfect example of how. It's amazing how hard media works to suppress reporting of Chicago violence because, you know, Chicago is this big socialist anti-gun mecca. I mean, if this was happening in a concealed carry state, you know, they'd be all over it that concealed carry isn't making people safer or something. But it's just amazing how in just what a snow job the media is doing on the violence in Chicago. I mean, the Chicago violence problem should be the shark story of the summer. And you know what I'm talking about, the shark story of the summer, a couple of shark attacks, and all of a sudden that's every newscast, shark attack, shark attack, shark attack. And in that case, you know, there's shark attacks all the time, but just, you know, you have a couple high profile ones and then all of a sudden it's the top news story on every show every day. But, you know, what's happening in Chicago, the fact that it's not, it's just, and we know why, and we know there's multiple reasons, certainly, but one of them is because Chicago is a socialist mecca, and Chicago prohibits citizens from being able to carry. And to make a big stink about the murder rate in Chicago would be to expose the failure of anti-gun legislation to expose the failure of Barack Obama's home city, home state policies, and the media is not going to do that. And they should be doing that. The Today Show should be out in front of somewhere in Chicago, and every time there's a murder, I mean, this would be the outrage of the day slash week slash month until something was done. But it's Chicago, so they get a free pass, and the media runs cover for the administration because it's such a socialist mecca, and it's just shameful. But here's a case where concealed carry could have saved a life, would have saved a life. You know, you can go look at the picture on the Well Armed Radio Facebook page, and it just, I mean, it's right there. You can see the husband is putting himself between. You know, he's going to be the sheepdog there. Unfortunately, he was disarmed by his government, unable to protect himself or his wife from this thug who came into his restaurant. Next topic we have, we got a lot of stuff. We got about a half hour, just over a half hour left for the show today, so we're still waiting to get to the big topics of the day. Last one, this Milwaukee freeway shootout. Some of you might have heard about this. This broke late last week. There was a shootout happened in Milwaukee, and there's a dispute of fact here. One person who's been arrested and charged said that he was sitting in his car when someone else pulled up next to him and flashed a gun, so he flashed his gun back. Then they took off down the freeway, and there's a Starsky and Hutch style shootout, you know, shooting out the tires of the car, shooting over their side. I mean, just everything that you might hear when you think about a movie. But, you know, this was reported, and I'm going to say this again, you know, if you don't read the newspaper, you're uninformed, and if you do read the newspaper, you're misinformed. But this shootout that happened in Milwaukee, there's a big stink about it now because they are both concealed carry holders. And we might do some more on this next week. I'm running short on time tonight, and I want to get to George Zimmerman trial. So we'll do some more on this next week. But basically, there is a dispute of fact, two concealed carry license holders. And that's another thing. You hear the media say that, you know, maybe we'll just go long tonight. Maybe we'll do a longer program and get all this in. But you hear the media talk about, especially Jerry Bonavia from Wave says, well, we don't know how well the concealed carry law is working because we don't know what happens when concealed carriers, license holders break the law. Well, here's a case where you've got a situation that occurred, and it's right out there in the media that both guys had concealed carry licenses. So Jerry Bonavia's contention is false right there. We do know what happens when concealed carry license holders get in trouble because it's, you know, now public record with what happened with this case. But again, there's dispute of fact of what really happened here. But what we do know is that one driver was cited felony charges for what he did, and the other driver was not cited. I was trying to get the not cited driver, concealed carry license holder, on the program for tonight, and I didn't get him on. So I think this is a topic hopefully we'll do next week, because I'd like to have him on. I've got a contact who knows him, so I'd like to have him on and get his side of the story. This is the gentleman who wasn't arrested. The gentleman who was arrested, he's been on local media talking about how, you know, he's been wrongfully charged. But you know, so I'm not going to rush to judgment of here, but I would say that you know, one participant, here's the things that I take away from this now, and we'll probably talk about this one next week, but I did some media interviews on Friday, and all the questions that they had, and how does this reflect on concealed carry? You know, here's two concealed carry license holders who, you know, this is road rage turned into a shootout, and this is what the anti-gun folks said would happen, and now it's happening. And, you know, when a drunk driver kills somebody, does the media come and stick a camera in someone's face and ask them, you know, are we sure we should be issuing driver's licenses? I mean, drunk drivers crash or kill somebody, and no one questions whether we're giving driver's licenses to people who shouldn't have them. No one questions whether we don't have good enough driver training. No one, we understand, rightfully so, that that's an individual breaking the law. But yet when a concealed carry license holder does it, they try to put the whole concept of citizens caring for self-defense on trial. And, you know, we know here in Milwaukee, just what's been reported in the news, there's been at least five instances over the past year and a half where a law-abiding citizen has deterred a crime, saved a life. The Aldi shooting, Nazir, the armed citizen in Aldi's, the first one. The most recent one, Charlie Blackmore, who concealed carry license holder, who stopped that domestic violence assault in West Dallas without firing a shot, held the perp at gunpoint. New Year's Day, a gentleman assaulted outside of Midtown Center, someone put a gun to his head, stole his wallet, ran away. He gave chase, guy pointed a gun at him, and he shot. That's the third. The barbershop scenario, the barbershop in Milwaukee where two thugs tried to break in. There was a concealed carry license holder inside who shot the suspects. And then the fifth one was a less reported one, but it was in the newspaper, who a guy and his son were in a car and someone tried to assault them and he shot the assailant. So that's five. So now we have one instance where maybe two concealed carry license holders got into a dust up. And again, there's a dispute of fact, but I think the record is stacking up very, very well for concealed carry in spite of this last one. And again, we'll wait to see what happens. But one thing I will say, the gentleman who's been charged in this instance, and again, this dispute of fact, we'll try to hammer that out next week by having Roy Scott is the name of the gentleman who I hope to have on next week. But there's a dispute of fact. But what we do know is that the person who was arrested has a long, lengthy disorderly conduct record. Now, disorderly conduct in itself is a misdemeanor and doesn't prohibit you from having a concealed carry license. But it just makes me question, I can't help but wonder if the gentleman who has been charged in this case, who is a concealed carry license holder, if some of those disorderly conduct charges were probably felonies that were later reduced or plea bargained down to misdemeanors. So here's a guy who maybe could have had a felony conviction. And again, we don't know, but I just throw it out there. Maybe could have had a felony conviction and wouldn't have been able to have possession legally of a gun at all. But again, this isn't a failure of concealed carry licenses or right to carry, but a failure of a soft on crime criminal justice system who had identified a perpetrator who might not be someone that should be carrying a gun. And instead of throwing the book at him, plea bargain these charges down to misdemeanors. And that's no indictment of right to carry. That's an indictment of a soft on crime criminal justice system. So that's that one. Next one, we're going to wrap that topic and we're going to jump into the topic of the night. And that is the George Zimmerman trial. So we'll probably take the next half hour on this one. I also want to get to the U.S. Bank, situation. And we'll see if we can fit that one in at the end of the show. George Zimmerman trial. You know, we all know what happened with the George Zimmerman trial, and now the verdict has come out yesterday, not guilty, late last night. And a couple angles. And the first one I'm going to start with this one is, you know, the possibility of protests. You know, this is now the aftermath. Verdict's been handed down. There's been some protests. There's been some riots, you know, not perhaps to the extent that some had predicted, but certainly I think in Oakland there was some evidence of rioting in Oakland and a few other cities. But a comment was made on the Wisconsin Carry Facebook page Saturday morning, and when someone had suggested that we should be vigilant, in one of our members, Brian, had suggested that we should be vigilant just in case the verdict comes down and you might find yourself, you know, some people could be, you know, heading to, well, a lot of these riots tend to take place in the inner city. So perhaps people might be heading into Milwaukee for a festival or to the bar scene or something. And, you know, the verdict comes down, you never know where one of these riots could break out. Someone had made the comment kind of chastising the original poster for suggesting that we should be vigilant in the possibility that there could be riots. Now, I might argue that we should be vigilant every day, and certainly we should, but, you know, vigilance is a grayscale. You know, not everybody is hypervigilant all the time. Certainly if we were vigilant all the time, we'd, you know, never be more than an arm's reach away from our sidearm, and that includes when you're showering or something. But so no one is absolutely perfectly vigilant, and on the other hand, the opposite of that, of just being a complete sheep, you know, there's few people who are completely sheep, although I'd argue I think the number of in the scale of people who are becoming sheep and moving that direction seems to be growing. Actually, it's more of a divide. I see some people moving towards the self-reliant sheepdog mentality, and then the other half moving the other way. It's they're polarizing, turning into sheep. But so this possibility of protest, and then we talk about training. And again, this is all, you know, bear with me for a second here as we talk about this George Zimmerman trial. But the possibility of protests, I think about training, you know, being vigilant. I think about training. And, of course, there's training the body. And then there's training the mind. Talk about training the mind. You know, I think about – I read a lot of books. And I've met – for a portion of my life, you know, when I was younger, I read a ton of books. I mean, I'm talking elementary school, middle school, really read a lot of books. And then through college, and you graduate, then you're kind of like, you want to be done with books. And I didn't do a lot of reading after that. I mean, I did some. I guess I probably more than most through my professional career. But then, you know, wasn't a big book reader over, you know, a 10-year period there. And I've definitely gotten back into reading books more and just really gathered some great things from them. But books are a great way to train your mind. Just the process of thought and visualization. Visualization is this process of training inside your head and going through scenarios in your imagination, and that your body will respond to. I mean, these are things that, that professional athletes do, and these are things that you and I can do, and these are things that I certainly do. I mean, but visualization is where you, you know, take some time, sit and think about scenarios, picture them in your head. What would happen if you were assaulted? How would you react? And think about everything as you sit there and visualize. Picture yourself in the situation. Picture yourself responding to the situation over and over in your head. And that literally is how you can condition your brain to respond. And the better you are at visualization, the more effective that mental conditioning works. And here's another suggestion. You know, the topic of my radio program is called Well-Armed Radio, and when I introduced this program several months back, I said that my hope and my goal was that together, you know, we would be better people, be better trained, better educated, more knowledgeable, armed with information, armed with knowledge, be well-armed. But the, you know, when we talk about visualization, and some people are great at visualization, and the better that you are at visualization, the better you can train for these hypothetical scenarios in your head, and the better your body will respond when they actually happen. And how do you get good at visualization? And here's my suggestion, and this is especially pertinent if you if you're a father or you have kids. Reading. Reading gives you mental input without the visual images. So your brain has to create those visual images because you're only getting half of the stimulus. If you watch TV, you get the story and the visuals that go along with it. And I think that's, and I'm not going to criticize society or make some bigger statement about where society is going, but when you used to have to listen to the radio, you were forced to visualize. Now, certainly there's skills that we have nowadays because of our use of computers and things and multimedia that people didn't have 50 years ago, but I don't know how old TV is, but it's more than 50 years, but say 75 years ago before TV. But there's skills that we have that they didn't, but there's also skills that they had perfected better that we are now losing. And my argument to you would be, if you can learn to acquire those skills in addition to the skills that, that are easy for us to acquire now, creative, for example, because we have so much multimedia stimulus. But if you can go back and train your brain the way that people used to be able to do, and when you used to listen to the radio, you had to visualize it. You almost all the entertainment stimulus that you had, you were hearing, and you had to create that picture in your head of what it looked like. One of the things that my mom did for me, and I didn't realize how valuable it was, but I'm so good at visualization. I can picture things. I just built out a theater in my basement, and I didn't even have to make plans for it. I just pictured it, and I built it. Never laid out plans, and it came out fantastically. I mean, people have seen my theater and just think it's phenomenal. But the reason I was able to do that is because I'm so good at visualization, and I think to myself, how did I get so good at being able to visualize? And my mom used to read to me when I was, you know, from the youngest age I can remember. I mean, and books that, you know, people are going to laugh, but I mean, Little House on the Prairie. My mom used to sit and read Little House on the Prairie to me, my brother, my sister every night before we went to bed. And when you get that kind of verbal input with no visual to go along with it, I would sit there in my head and I would imagine the stories as she's reading them to me, and I would create the picture in my head. And by doing that, I got really good at visualization from a very, very young age. And then think about that. You know, read to your kids. The best thing, when people talk about reading to your kids, it's, I mean, there's so many benefits of that, but it's sitting and doing something with them. It's connecting with them, all of those things. But it's also conditioning their brain to be able to visualize. And that's a skill that they're going to use throughout their life. And they'll be a better person and better than their peers in terms of mental function if you can do that. So to all the fathers out there, or mothers, if you're listening, read to your kids. I'm not going to say don't let them watch TV, because I still watched TV when I was a kid. But, I mean, reading is something that, that creates a mental capacity. So first, to read to your kids before they can read to themselves. But then encourage your kids to read. And even fiction. Even fiction. You don't have to read something boring. But even fiction practices the brain in visualization. When we're younger, that fiction is something that we read and allows us to visualize. As we get older, I think we start to turn more to nonfiction, and we start reading for knowledge. As we get older, reading for knowledge, we're you know, we don't want to reinvent the wheel. There's knowledge that other people have already acquired, and rather than us starting from scratch and going back and acquiring that, you know, we don't have to figure out how to the laws of gravity. Someone already researched that, so we can quickly acquire that knowledge, and then we can go beyond what's already been acquired. That's how civilizations advance. If each person had to recreate the knowledge from scratch that other people have already mastered, civilizations would never progress. So by reading, and I've noticed this in my life, I mean, some things I had to sit there, even some emotional things as you know, grow up from adolescence to, you know, how to deal with your emotions and love yourself. When you can read some books about people who've already figured that out, it accelerates your ability to figure it out for yourself, and then you can start building and acquiring more knowledge. But anyway, I don't want to get too far on the topic here, but this is about George Zimmerman. I'm going to get back there. But so throughout this program, I'm going to share some things that I'm reading with you. I'm going to encourage you to share things that you're reading with me. I will tell you that the next on my list, I've already started reading Art of War. And I tell you this, and let's be honest, the world's a competitive place. Some might say, let's hoard the knowledge we have and not share it with other people, because if we're better than other people in terms of our intelligence and productivity, that benefits us. You know, if I'm a better basketball player than if I'm a professional basketball player and I figure out how to do something better and I don't tell anybody else, one might think that then, you know, that's better for your success. But then other people look at it and say, hey, if I share the knowledge I have, then other people are going to be better. And that's going to challenge me to be even better yet, because that competitive drive. And that's why I think we should share information, because that competition makes you even better than you otherwise would have been. You know, some people argue that patent law suppresses development because people don't have to continue to innovate. They can patent something and ride that patent for 10 years, where if you couldn't patent something, you would still create it. But because other people could too, you'd have to create something new or something better. Some argue that patent law encourages competition, and some argue that patent law suppresses competition. So, competitive environment, you know, competition makes you better. And lastly, I think we have a moral obligation to expand knowledge and share the knowledge we have. And so I'm going to start to bring this back to George Zimmerman. Denial. Lieutenant Dave Grossman, I'm not going to take credit for this, but Tim Schmidt, who's the president of the United States Concealed Carry Association, and I are very good friends, and he gave me a 5-disc DVD set from Lieutenant Dave Grossman's Bulletproof Mind series. And I've begun to watch those on nights when there's, you know, nothing good on TV. Throw that in and start watching these DVDs. And Lieutenant Dave Grossman talks about denial in his series. And this is a quote from him, and it's that denial kills you twice. Denial kills you once at the moment of truth, when you are not physically prepared, you didn't bring your gun, you didn't train, your only defense was wishful thinking. Hope is not a strategy. Denial kills you a second time, because even if you do physically survive, you are psychologically shattered by your fear, helplessness, and horror at your moment of truth. Someone suggested that we should be vigilant in the verdict, possible verdict for George Zimmerman's trial. And someone else said, oh, you guys are just being fearmongers. And that's denial. And denial kills you twice. and I'm going to read this again. It kills you once at your moment of truth when you are not physically prepared. You didn't bring your gun. You didn't train. Your only defense was wishful thinking. Hope is not a strategy. But denial kills you a second time, because even if you do physically survive, you are psychologically shattered by your fear, helplessness, and horror at your moment of truth. What if there was a riot in Milwaukee yesterday? And what if, because of denial, someone decided, I'm not going to carry today. Nothing's going to happen. If you survive that violent encounter of a riot, and you weren't, but others, let's say others didn't, what kind of psychological fallout would you have? You know, we hear people talk about survivor's guilt all the time, and we know that being involved in a self-defense shooting situation has physical ramifications, emotional ramifications, but so does doing nothing. So does being a victim, has even greater ramifications. So what if there was a, you know, these people outside of State Fair a couple of years ago, what if that when those riots occurred, people say riots couldn't happen in Wisconsin. They happened in Wisconsin. People rioted outside for no reason, rioted outside of State Fair. They didn't need a George Zimmerman verdict, but people were rioting outside of State Fair, beating people, beating mothers, beating fathers, you know, pulling kids from strollers. I mean, this is the kind of savagery that exists out there. And if you think it doesn't, you are living in denial, and your denial will kill you twice. So I'm looking forward to the rest of this Lieutenant Dave Grossman series that I've been watching the DVDs of. I'm going to share those with you on upcoming shows. But so now that's my topic when we start talking about this George Zimmerman case. We talk about protests. Be prepared, and don't just be prepared for the possibility of riots. I'm not talking about putting on body armor, but I mean, this is what we talk about when we talk about denial, and don't live in denial. I'm going to pause for a second here. I use my laptop for my notes, and I'm running short on battery. So while I give me a second here while I plug this in and try to multitask. But one second. All right. We are now plugged in. So it's kind of funny. I watched the Wisconsin Carry page sometimes, or I've got my Facebook page open because my my call screener, Dan, we message through Facebook. So while I'm doing the program now, I'm going to get probably about 50 messages through Facebook while I'm trying to do my program here. But I just saw one pop up from one of these people who poo-pooed the idea that we should be vigilant and prepared if there was riots. And it's funny because that's another person who's continuing to live in denial, and he knows who he is. But so we had some protests. There's and then the news tonight, they talked about protests in Milwaukee. And honestly, I don't think we're out of the woods yet. I think there could be more protests because we know that the race baiters and the race hustlers in this country need racial division, need racial conflict. So just because there was no riots here yesterday doesn't mean that when they have time, when I say they, I'm talking about these community organizers, these race baiters, these race hustlers, doesn't mean that they don't have time to fan the flames and stir the outrage here. And I'm convinced that they will. I'm convinced that the media is going to give them a stage to fan the flames. I mean, Al Sharpton's already been in the news talking about how, I read, you know, he's misquoted, or he's quoted, and he's saying that this stand your ground law has to be abolished. And we both know that, or we all know, the educated folks among us know that stand your ground law wasn't even at issue here. They didn't even use stand your ground defense, but that's not stopping Al Sharpton from trying to attack stand your ground laws. We know that the facts of the case with regard to George Zimmerman's case, but now the race hustlers want to make this all about race. Now the Department of Justice, just late today, the Department of Justice was talking about the possibility of civil rights charges against George Zimmerman. Civil rights charges are something that usually we see when police officers are acquitted of, for example, state charges, and then because of their role as police, they can be put up for federal charges, even if they've been, it's kind of a wiggle around the double jeopardy rule. But there's still a lot to be said for this George Zimmerman case, and this is not over by a long stretch of the imagination. So looking back in this case, NBC did their best to try to convict George Zimmerman before the trial ever happened. NBC is currently facing a lawsuit from George Zimmerman. Remember, NBC doctored the 911 call to make it sound more nefarious than it was when they played that. Without NBC doing what they did, who knows if this would have made the national stink that it did? Who knows if they would have been able to stir the outrage that they were able to stir? In addition, the president should have never gotten involved and said what he said. You know, the president came on and said, if I had a son, he would have looked like Trayvon. And that may be true because we know from the president's book how much drugs he did in high school. And we know from evidence presented that Trayvon was using drugs and was in trouble for fighting and a bunch of other things. I mean, this was no altar boy. So if President Obama had a son, indeed, he may have looked like Trayvon. I guess he was accurate when he said that. But that's not the kind of thing that a president should be doing. A president who said he was going to come into office and part the waters and heal all racial divides shouldn't be on TV fanning the flames of outrage. He should be the voice of calm, the voice of not jumping to conclusions, the voice of letting the justice system work. So a couple other reports from this week. There's some information that's come out about the Department of Justice Community Relations Service, CRS, and Thomas Battles. Thomas Battles is people who are on the payroll of the Department of Justice Community Relations Service were sent down to Sanford, Florida during the unrest in that 40 days between when the George Zimmerman, Trayvon Martin shooting occurred and when the charges were filed. But the Department of Justice sent people down there, and the Judicial Watch group accuses the Department of Justice of working to foster the unrest in Florida. So you can Breitbart.com has this article from this week where Thomas Battles was speaking to a church, and I've listened to the whole audio. I was going to try to pull audio for the show, but it's hard to hear. It's someone's recording on poor equipment at this church where there was this meeting with this Department of Justice officials and local people there in Sanford. But Judicial Watch is accusing them of fostering the unrest in Florida. And I got to be honest, with all the other things that we see the Department of Justice doing, Fast and Furious and all these other things, it's not a big stretch to think that they would. There's also this possibility of federal rights charges now. George Zimmerman's not out of the woods. We'll have to wait and see what happens there. I think this is scary stuff. So, I mean, feel free to call in if you have some, your reaction, 646-716-8739. Do you think that this was the right verdict? What do you think about your predictions for more charges? I was trying to get one of Wisconsin Kerry's attorneys on tonight to talk about these federal civil rights charges. And I don't know. This is a tough one. I think that the Department of Justice is going to do all they can to talk about civil rights charges. I would be surprised if George Zimmerman faced civil rights charges. But this administration has surprised me before, and they'll probably continue to. So I guess the only good thing I can say, unfortunately, is that we'll have more topics for this, for this program in the future with regard to the George Zimmerman case. But I think justice was served. I think it's clear from the evidence that, this is a case that perhaps never should have been filed. I think you could make the argument the charges should have never been brought here. I think the charges were politically motivated. I think that without the intervention of politics into this case, we wouldn't be talking about it today. I think this case has nothing to do with anything other than self-defense in terms of the legal question. However, in terms of the political question, I think that's what remains to be seen, is what the powers that be are going to do with this case, because this is their hot-button political tactic. And it's clear that the administration never lets a good crisis go to waste, to quote Rahm Emanuel. And it'll be interesting to see what else happens with this case, with George Zimmerman, with possible federal charges. I think that justice was served. I think the verdict was just. And I think that based on all the evidence that we heard, you know, you kept hearing people say that here's a prosecution witness that was a poor witness. Well, when you have a poor case, that's all that you are going to have is poor witnesses. I don't think the prosecution did a bad job in this case. I think the prosecution did the best job they could with bad facts, with poor facts, with facts that don't support their contention. It's interesting here in Milwaukee, some, quote, conservative radio talk show hosts, after this case initially broke, you know, a year and a half ago, condemned George Zimmerman immediately, called him John Wayne. I think Jay Weber called him, this is a John Wayne guy with a John Wayne complex. And, of course, Jay Weber has since changed his tune. But even conservative folks were jumping to conclusions on this one. And I think that what we have seen here is that the criminal justice system still does work in most cases. And I think it worked in this case. I think that any reasonable person, and some people, you know, unfortunately, I shouldn't say unfortunately, the jury system, the criminal justice system that we have isn't based upon formulating a hypothesis and weighing the preponderance of evidence. In a civil case, yes. In a civil case, when all you're talking about is damages and usually money, you can sit there and, you know, put one in one hand and one in the other and kind of weigh them and say, I suspect my gut, you know, I lean this way. But that's not the standard in a criminal case. And the standard in a criminal case is beyond a reasonable doubt. So you don't sit there and say, you know, I kind of believe Trayvon, the story they're telling about Trayvon, the situation that the prosecution put out, I kind of believe that. I think I'm leaning towards believing that, but I'm not sure. And it also doesn't say, yeah, I kind of believe George Zimmerman's story a little bit more. We're talking about reasonable doubt, beyond any reasonable doubt. So those jury members have to have no doubt that in order to convict George Zimmerman, no doubt that his story was false, that he attacked Trayvon, that he initiated that encounter. And certainly they couldn't do that. And that's the system of justice that we have. So I have a hard time finding even people who, and there's members of the Wisconsin Carry Facebook page who have said that they think that George Zimmerman should be found guilty. And then they tell the story about why they think that. And it's based upon drawing a conclusion, based upon making assumptions from some of the facts and ignoring others. But I think if those people took a look back and said, no, this isn't about drawing a picture and a scenario in my head and letting my biases and my personal perspective draw a conclusion, connect the dots. This is about challenging what you've concluded and challenging yourself to say, is there a reasonable doubt? And I don't see how anybody couldn't have a reasonable doubt that George Zimmerman should be found not guilty, because his story was corroborated by the evidence. And it's still possible, because we will never know, it's still possible that George Zimmerman initiated that contact. We don't know. It's possible that George Zimmerman followed Trayvon, and Trayvon could have hidden a bush because he didn't want to be caught or something, and came out of the bushes and George Zimmerman said, what are you doing here, and punched him. I mean, that's possible. But it's also possible that the story that George Zimmerman told was completely true. And based upon the evidence that was presented at trial, I don't see how anybody could come to anything but a reasonable doubt that the charge of murder and even manslaughter didn't apply. I don't think anybody could say beyond a reasonable doubt it wasn't self-defense. I don't know how anybody could say that. So no calls on that, but no problem. I'm confident that this George Zimmerman case is going to be in the news for another couple of weeks, so we'll have more to talk about with that. Last topic, we got a couple minutes left here, so we'll run through this one quick. U.S. Bank. Last week, a member of Wisconsin Carry who carries into his local U.S. Bank branch, I don't want to say where he lives because keep his anonymity, but received a letter from the bank. U.S. Bank doesn't post their buildings. If you go to any U.S. Bank building, there's no signs that say Carry is not allowed here. But this gentleman, concealed carry license holder, went into a U.S. bank, received a letter in the mail. Obviously, he has an account there. They know where he lives. They sent him a threatening letter, and the letter said a couple things that were pretty, shocking. And there's a couple different angles when you read that letter that make you give you pause. There's obviously just the poor customer service angle, given that, you know, as a customer, it doesn't make sense to send threatening letters. So I'll read this letter and you can decide for yourself. Mr. I'll keep the name blank here. U.S. Bank recently learned that you may have carried a weapon onto U.S. Bank premises. For the safety of all U.S. Bank customers and employees, U.S. Bank policy states that the possession of weapons is prohibited on U.S. Bank premises. Accordingly, please refrain from bringing any weapon onto U.S. Bank premises in the future. Further action will be taken if a U.S. Bank employee observes or learns that you or any other customer is in possession of a weapon on U.S. Bank premises. And this is signed by, this letter, threatening letter, is signed by Kelly King, a corporate security fraud investigator for U.S. Bank. I'll give out her number. Her number, 414-765-4896, a direct number for Kelly King, corporate security fraud investigator for U.S. Bank, 414-765-4896. U.S. Bank's a big bank. This letter certainly isn't addressed to just Mr. Again, I'm going to leave his name off, but this letter is not just directed to the gentleman who received it, but it says further action will be taken if a U.S. Bank employee observes or learns that you or any other customer is in possession of a weapon on U.S. Bank premises. So by that, if U.S. Bank learns that you, listening to this show, who might be a customer of U.S. Bank, you know, if they have a mole on the Wisconsin Carry Facebook page and someone says, yeah, I bank in U.S. Bank and there's no sign, so I carry there. Well, based upon this letter, U.S. Bank is threatening that if they learn, not observe, but learn that you were carrying on U.S. Bank property, they're going to take further action. Now, I don't know what that further action might be. I guess we'll have to, that might be something that if you're a U.S. Bank customer, you might want to call Kelly King at 414-765-4896 and ask her that very question. But the other angles here for this letter from U.S. Bank, obviously there's banks all over Wisconsin, large banks, small banks, and they've done the right thing and chosen not to post. They recognize that posting a bank, a place where people come and go with large amounts of cash, is probably one of the stupidest things that you can do to put your customers at risk, make them a target. Now here, in this case, U.S. Bank didn't have the courtesy to post a sign. You know, there are banks that are posted. We know some credit unions around Wisconsin, some small credit unions are posted. And Wisconsin Carry hasn't made a big stink about that. You know, they post their policy. It's stupid. It makes people victims. But it's their choice to be stupid and have stupid policies. I mean, many companies do it. When I say do it, I'm not talking about just posting, but make bad business decisions. But in this case, to not have the courtesy to do what the law suggests and post your entrances with 5x7 signs, U.S. Bank decides to send a threatening letter. I think that's horrible customer service beyond the fact that it's putting your customers at risk. I think that it's not the way you should treat your customers. I think it's not the message you should send to criminals that all the people coming in and out of our bank are unarmed. And the other thing to mention is that the letter is factually inaccurate. Parking lots are an exception. Parking structures are an exception. U.S. Bank cannot prohibit you from having a gun, loaded gun, in your car on U.S. Bank property. So when they talk about their premises, they are overstepping their rights as a private property owner to prohibit you from having a gun in your car on their property. If they allow your car on their property, they have to allow your gun in your car on their property. But I would encourage you, if you're a U.S. Bank customer, Well, I won't tell you what to do, but I think you should be aware of that as you make your business decisions about where you want to do your banking. I can tell you that Wisconsin Carry banks at Associated Bank, as do I personally, and Associated Bank allows carry. There's many other banks, large banks across Wisconsin that allow carry. So you do have choices. You don't have to patronize a bank who not only chooses to do something so foolish as prohibit customers from carrying, but also does something so inadvisable in terms of customer service as sending a threatening letter to your home. But you should be aware. Other options, U.S. Bank has a Facebook page. If you go to Facebook and search for U.S. Bank, you'll get their Facebook page, and you can certainly leave your opinion there. Lots of people have done so. But U.S. Bank broke a lot of rules here, a lot of principles of business. And one of those principles of business is something an attorney here in Wisconsin that I've had the pleasure of working with over the years has said is it's the 5 o'clock rule. And if you ask what the 5 o'clock rule is, it's, well, don't do anything that's going to end you up on the 5 o'clock news. That's what U.S. Bank did here. Thanks to Wisconsin Carrying Our members, we made sure that this ended up on the news. And this is not good public relations for U.S. Bank. They should be in the business of banking and protecting people's financial assets. And instead, they're in the business of threatening customers and exposing them to risk. So that's the show for today. We ran, looks like we ran 5 minutes overtime there. So good for me. I have something that I'm going to start to do is what I'm going to call my quote of the week. If I hear a quote that I like, I'm going to save it for my program and at least have one of these quotes every week. And so here's my quote of the week for this week. This is from Lieutenant Dave Grossman. Obviously, I'm tipping my hand here. Again, I have been watching the series Bulletproof Mind from Lieutenant Dave Grossman. I'm going to continue probably to talk about that for the next few weeks as I work my way through that series. But this quote from Lieutenant Grossman, I think, is the one that I want to leave you with here today. And that is, I am not impressed if you could hit a golf ball 200 yards. I am impressed if you could hit a golf ball at 200 yards. Lieutenant Dave Grossman. My name's Nick Clark, host of Well Armed Radio. You've been listening to Well Armed Radio. Thanks for tuning in. Catch us on Facebook at facebook.com/wellarmedradio. Catch us on next Sunday night at 8 p.m. live. And be welcome to call, tune in, call in, and be well armed. Have a good night.